I'm HRN's Communications Director Kat Johnson with a preview of this week's episode of Meat in 3, our weekly food news roundup. Fall is finally here, so it's time to get funky and devote an episode to some of our favorite spunky microbes.
Fungi just provide this beautiful, whimsical lens on how the world works. They have so many roles. They're this strange and magical-seeming group of organisms, but they've got it all figured out.
Should you eat the cheese rind? Can you eat the rind? These are like the biggest questions.
We'll answer all of your questions about mysterious mushrooms and crazy curds. Plus, we'll give you a sneak listen to the newest season of Modernist Breadcrumbs. So tune in to this week's Meat in 3 on Heritage Radio Network, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
This episode is brought to you by Heritage Foods, an online and wholesale distributor of heritage breed meat and poultry. Learn more at heritagefoods.com.
Hello, hello, Heritage Radio Network listeners tuning in from 165 countries around the world, about a million listens a month.
Wow.
And today, I hope every single one of them is listening to this episode of Tech Bites, the weekly show where we talk about the intersection of food and technology. And I say this every single time. We have a really great show. And I say it every single time, but I really mean it. Each and every time. Today we're going to talk about aquaponics, and we know that it's great for the environment, but we're going to find out if it's great on the plate and if it tastes good. To do that, we have a couple guests in studio with us today. We have Jason Green, who is the co-founder and CEO of Brooklyn-based Edenworks, which is an aquaponics company. Jason, thank you for coming. You're
hey,
a couple blocks away. I can't believe it's taken us 3 years to get you on the show.
Yeah, a little bit of me ghosting on some emails.
Yeah, but exactly. Well, you're here, and that's what's important.
Yeah, thanks for having
and
me.
And joining us as our seafood chef focus group of one, Bill Telepan, who is the chef of Oceana Restaurant in New York City, longtime sustainable guy. Right?
Right, yeah.
Fish expert, sustainable fish expert.
Almost a fish expert.
Almost getting there. You're getting there?
I've been there a little over 2 years now. So, I mean, the volume of fish we go through, the education's been pretty quick, so.
But you've been a chef for decades in New York, and you've always been interested in local and sustainable and organic and all that good stuff.
Yeah, and but most of my menus have been sort of more vegetable, meat-focused, and a little fish. Actually, there was a point when I had Telepan where, you know, there was all this talk about fish, mercury in the fish, and prices of fish was going too high, and you know, just the sustainability of fish. I was like, you know what, maybe I should just get rid of seafood. Except I had a smoked trout dish that everyone loved and a lobster bolognese dish that everyone loved. So, and then I was introduced to a couple interesting people, like the Dr. Dish program, and through a lot of people you find, you know, you learn about it. But now the education's been pretty, you know, intense.
Thorough, intense, yeah. Focused.
Focused.
Well, before we get to aquaponics, Edenworks, fish, we're going to start the show like we always do, which is we go around the shipping container and we talk about apps. And those are not the precursor to a meal, snacky little food things, appetizers, but apps that live on your smartphone. Maybe something new that you just discovered that you love, or maybe something that's been living on your home screen for 10 years. Because it's been 10 years.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
You go first, Jason.
And, Jason, the only rule is you cannot talk about an app that you own, designed, or invest in.
Got it.
Which is a,
no
which is a critical
problem here.
Which is a critical point for the tech founders.
Yeah.
Because people are usually serial entrepreneurs and have their hand in more than one tech company.
Yeah. So I love Airtable. Airtable is a combination of like spreadsheet forms, and also you can do kind of drag and drop stuff that is almost like coding, and it's just super functional. So if you want to like quickly build a workflow, I love Airtable. I love Google Sheets and like use Google Sheets and Google Calendar and all that. And Airtable's like one up on top of all of that for custom workflows. It's super cool.
So custom workflows, does that mean it's a paid app or is it a free app or is it free but then incremental add-ons for functionality or?
Yeah, so it's a freemium model. You can start off for free. We use it for recruiting, for example, at Edenwork. So we'll build a form. That form will get embedded in our job postings. We'll then collect all of that. We can comment on candidates and build like a ranked list and turn that into a task for another colleague. And all of that is free. And then if you want to do more advanced stuff, if you want to layer code on top of that, if you want to build certain premium features into it, then there are paid options. But you can do a ton of stuff for free. And it's like 10 minutes to build an app. I built an app for my wife and I were looking for a new apartment. And in about 10 minutes, I built an app where I could grab the information on the listing, take a picture of the property when we're there, add comments.
Phone.
I built it on my laptop just because it was faster to be able to use a mouse. But then it's automatically mobile native. And so then we went to these apartments and I'm taking pictures and like 10 minutes to build.
That's
to build
pretty
an
awesome.
App.
Yeah.
Do you come with the app?
Do I come with the
Do
app?
Do you come with the app?
I don't. Okay. Because
me to get maximum efficiency out of it, I need you.
That's a premium feature.
Premium feature. So I'm looking at Bill Talapan, who's... I'm going to say you're an analog guy.
Yeah.
And we were talking just before the show. He put me a little bit on blast because he hasn't been on the show yet. And I'm like, but it's a tech show. And as soon as Jason said Airtable, did you think... The game? Did you think air table?
I was thinking air hockey. Yeah,
like, yes, I
was
like, I knew it.
I went looking on my phone to find it because I don't have it, and I get a long subway ride. I'm sick of solitaire already.
No Candy Crush?
Yeah, I had to get rid of a lot. I mean, it's just too much. It's too much going on.
So.
Apps. I mean, like, I don't...
Not appetizer.
Right. You know, I think the one since I do a lot of running around the city, even though I work in one restaurant, but I do a lot because of the schoolwork I do with wellness in the schools, and now I'm working at the Institute of Culinary Education. I use City Mapper a lot.
Okay.
Which will tell me, like, what time... You know, it's a good way to get, you know, time without using Google Maps, but I like to use the subway because it's the best way to get around. And then I go right to the solitaire. All right, which I'm pretty awesome at.
The one that's preloaded on
your
phone.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know all that stuff. In fact, the other day I had to write a kid a letter to, you know, a letter of recommendation for college. And I'm sitting there and I'm writing it. And he wrote it, you know, he did it. And then I fixed it up. And then I added my signature. And it, you know, went indented. And I didn't know how to get it over. So I had to call my wife. I said, can you help me with this? And so she just fixed it and sent it to me. Yeah, I'm not terrible with computers. I have all my recipes on there. I have, you know, imagine for the last 20 years, I've been just logging stuff on there. So I know how to use that. And so I put everything on Dropbox. And so it lives there. Because Google... Docs is kind of like, you know, I don't really get it yet. You know? I mean, I do use it, but now everything's all over the place. So I just sort
too
of
too many things.
Throw everything on Dropbox,
right?
And then I could find it. And so it's cool. So I'll be at home and I want to cook something. I'm like, oh, what's that recipe I have?
You go to the Dropbox.
I go to the Dropbox. It comes up.
You know, there's an app for that. You can put it on your phone.
What?
Dropbox.
I have that.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. So I guess Dropbox is kind of cool.
Yeah. Okay. All right, are you ready for this?
Bill is on the cloud. Yeah.
No, I'm not even on the cloud. Well, I refuse to go on the cloud.
Dropbox is in the cloud.
That's a cloud, but I don't have, like, I'm not on the cloud. Like, I don't have anything.
You are, you just don't realize
it. I probably am. Like, I was thinking about this, like, you know, like City Bike, because I have the key and I have that app, and that's cool too. I know how to use that well because it tells you where to park it and all that, right? And I'm like, but I refuse to log in because I'm like, I don't want them to know where I am. But you know what? I use the key and I'm like, they know where I am. Everything. Yeah. They know who we are.
And your phone is tracking you even when it's on and off because you're opted in. There's like a 17-step process to go in and get the tracking stopped on your phone.
See, that's a little too much.
Yeah. All right. Well, are you ready for this? Because I saved this for the end.
This...
No. Wait. You're going to love this. Gnome.
Hey, guys.
So Gnome doesn't... He participates in the app segment, but in a slightly different way.
He brings appetizers?
No. Gnome.
I'm going to give you my tech gripe of the week. So I have a flip phone.
He doesn't have apps.
And
I've never had a smartphone, ever.
What drives me crazy is when someone sends me a link to something, and then I have to send a text with the link to my email, and then I can look at it when I get home. That just drives me nuts.
Do people who know you not know that you're on a smartphone?
I think people don't think about it. So even people who know me, it's just like that's what you do. You send it in a message, and then
on a flip phone.
You know, when my daughter was, she had a flip phone, and up until she entered high school, and all of her friends that have had smartphones and iPhones, and they were all on Instagram and blah blah blah. And then there was a point where we were just like, if she was entering high school, we're like, all right, well, we'll get her a smartphone, right? But it was like, no apps, no Instagram, none of that stuff. We don't want you to do posting anything like that. My wife always talks about how, like, people can see it. It can be embarrassing, blah, blah, blah. And then it turned to a point where the kids were only communicating on Snapchat. And so she was out of a lot of conversations. So there was a point where we were just like, well, what's going on? She's like, well, everyone that goes on Snapchat and so we finally let her go on Snapchat, which is bad because everything disappears,
You can record it, though. It doesn't.
You can, but we can't go into it and find it. It goes away. Mm-hmm. So, but that's how they text each other through Snapchat. They send these pictures of them.
They're doing it because it disappears.
Like half their faces, and they're like, what's up?
Don't you think you would be driven crazy, though, if you could see it? Because it's like forgetting anything that might get sent that like you really wouldn't want to see. But
forget it. No.
It'd be knowing somebody's interior monologue, right? It'd be like, do you, like...
And what happens is, like, you see these pictures of these 14-year-old girls, like, in these poses, and everyone writes, oh, you're so cute, oh, you're beautiful, oh, you're so cute, oh, you're... So, and then you might get that one random kid who'd be like, oh, then all the shit starts, the bullying can start off of it, and it's kind of bad. So it's like, fortunately for her, knock on wood, she has a good group of friends, there's not a lot of that going on, but you know it exists, right? I mean, kids have committed suicide because of it. We've learned that.
My cousin's got an 11-year-old daughter, and she had a smartphone for just a couple of weeks. Something happened. I don't know if the phone broke or she lost it or something like that. And then said, Mom, Dad, I don't want a replacement.
Wow. Good for her.
It was too much pressure for her.
Yeah. And there's that too, right?
Yeah. Which is kind of, it's very self-aware for an 11-year-old.
That's amazing. Yeah.
Well, maybe I'm so fascinated by Gnome and his flip phone life that we may actually do an episode with Gnome and the flip phone. I'm also, for listeners out there.
It would only outlast a minute.
In the 100 and it's fascinating.
It's only one feature.
Sorry, no.
He can't.
Nuances.
What's that?
I'll say this. My phone has a flashlight. Does yours?
Yeah, flashlight. Mine does.
Bill knows how to work that.
I do, yeah.
So,
because I'm old now, and I have to see things differently. So,
just using how's the lighting in your restaurant?
The lighting in the restaurant is bright.
So I don't need my phone to read the menu.
No.
Okay, so we digress a little bit, but I'm just fascinated by the flip phone life. So maybe we'll do a low tech show. And if you are a restaurant owner or work in a restaurant or know a restaurant that is not on social media that still uses the old reservation book and the pencil, you people know what I'm talking about. I am desperate to find a restaurant that is all analog, that is not on OpenTable, that is not on Resy, that is not doing any of those newfangled things, but is just really running it old school.
Emilio Bellotto.
Really? I don't know who that is.
You can't make a reservation. You know that Italian restaurant on Houston Street?
Oh, yeah. Okay.
It's great. We were just there. I don't think they have like a, I didn't see.
You know what I'm talking about? Yeah. The red book with the rubber band and the pencil.
Yeah, just Gotham. When I worked at Gotham, it was the big book. It would look, scribbling. Yep. I'm like thinking like, how did they ever do that? How did they work that way? I mean, I guess they had a system.
The pencil.
The pencil.
So you could erase.
Yeah, I guess so. There you go.
So. We digress.
That was tech advance way back when, guess, right?
The eraser or the pencil?
Both.
It was iteration.
Well, how do we use this? Well, let's use the eraser. This, right?
Yeah, that was the upgrade. That was the 2.0.
Premium features.
So, Edenworks. Edenworks is about 5 blocks away from Roberta's Pizza in Bushwick. They've been around since 2013. It is aquaponics. And if you don't know what aquaponics is, that is basically aquaculture, which means raising things in water, animals like fish and shrimps, combined with hydroponics, which is growing plants in water. And it creates this nice closed system where you use the fish water to fertilize the plant water, and it's all nice and self-contained. And it is going to be the farming of the future. It's going to save the environment. It's going to save the food supply and all the airborne diseases and all those kinds of things. And I've been reading a bunch of different reports online that peg the growth of the aquaponics industry anywhere from like 7 to 11% over the next few years. By about 2023, I recently read a report that said the aquaponics industry will be worth about $1.3 billion US. So that's kind of amazing. So if you are familiar with the space, one of the fish that they grow is typically tilapia because it's easy to grow. It's a very adaptable fish. They don't mind being crowded. They can adapt to different types of water temperatures. So it makes it really easy to grow in this situation. But I myself am not a huge fan of tilapia, and most tilapia that's farmed has that really kind of gross metallic muddy taste from being farmed.
Yeah, kind of like that
and
mushy.
Like mashy and mushy. Yeah. So it's not the best, and it's certainly not high-end, and I doubt that, you know, gross farm-raised tilapia would be something that a chef like Bill Telepan would serve at Oceana.
We're serving groceries from.
So Jason and the team at Edenworks have been developing new kinds of fish that are maybe more in line with what people want to eat and more in line with what people are eating from the wild. And they landed on striped bass, which is a local New York City, not New York City, but a local New York fish. People mm-hmm. know it. People are familiar with it. And it's an easy trade from getting it from the ocean to getting it from Brooklyn. So it's not quite on the market yet, but we had Jason send Bill some of the fish so we could find out how it tastes and how it cooks. But first, Jason, tell us, at what point did you realize that you need to sort of branch out from the typical tilapia into things that maybe were more diverse?
We've always known that kind of the advantage of growing indoors is the ability to produce stuff that would otherwise have to be imported. Tilapia have, as you said, they've historically been done in aquaponics and in lots of aquaculture, fish farming in general, because of the lack of environmental control. You wanted to grow a fish that was hardy, something that was going to survive changes in weather, something that was going to be somewhat disease resistant, or, you know, unfortunately with a lot of tilapia, it's just being treated with a ton of antibiotics and hormones. But once you move indoors and you've got kind of full control over that environment, you can create whatever climate you want. And so we're doing this beautiful striped bass, and maybe Bill will tell us if it was beautiful or not. But we do this really beautiful striped bass. And the next fish that we're going to do are salmon and shrimp as well. And so the ability to create that climate gives us the ability to produce a cold water fish, a warm water fish, or, you know, even a tropical fish, salt water, fresh water. There's just a huge amount of flexibility that gives us. And that, we think, is some of the beauty of growing indoors, is to create local fresh production of products that otherwise would have to come from halfway across the world because of the unique climate in which that product needs to grow.
So it makes a lot of sense that you picked a fish that the New York market knows because it is from the New York market. Are there particular touch points about the waters off New York that you were trying to replicate, or did you have to alter your current system to replicate, you know, what the Atlantic's like? And
so the fish that we're growing is, it's a hybrid varietal of striped bass. So think about it like a cockapoo. It's a little bit of a mutt. So it's a striped bass that's been crossed with a white bass. Now, striped bass, local New York population. White bass is a lake of freshwater dwelling fish. And so the striped bass that we grow, it looks very much like a striped bass, but smaller. It's more kind of the size of a white bass. Grows to market size at about 1.5 pounds, maybe up to 2 pounds. But with the striped bass that you might see off of Long Island, I mean, those are very large fish. You could find, you know, 20 pound fish. And so this kind of looks like a striped bass, but much smaller. It's got the flavor profile more like a striped bass as opposed to white bass, but it's really good for growing in a farming operation like ours because of that white bass, more like lake dwelling, as opposed to the striped bass, which is a migratory fish. And so it's trying to bring a product into market that the New York consumer is familiar with, but that is also compatible with farming technology. That way we're not forcing a square peg into a round hole.
I have a very quick question that I want to ask, but I don't want to get sidetracked. There's so many interesting things about this. Is the hybrid striped bass that you're growing, did you engineer that yourselves? Does that exist? Did you get it from someplace? How does that work? Because it sounds ideal, because obviously a lake is much more like a tank than the ocean, and you want something that's not going to want to migrate because there's not much place to go in a tank.
Yeah, so in the same way that when you're buying tomatoes, that farmer that grew those tomatoes bought a particular seed, right. Somebody developed those seeds.
Yes.
And those seeds have been developed over generations of growing, where growers selected for certain traits. Mm-hmm. The same thing happens with growing animals. There are growers who are buying particular genetics, particular characteristics, and that we're not referring to genetically modified, but we're selective breeding. Yeah,
right. It's a very fine point. It's a sticky subject.
Yeah, but it's what farmers have been doing for the past 10,000 years. And right. So what we're doing is we're buying from a hatchery
So you're buying baby fish.
We're buying baby fish from a hatchery that specifically does hybrid striped bass. So what they do is they have a population of striped bass, they have a population of white bass, and then they are selectively breeding those together to create the hybrid that the mutt, quote unquote, that we're
growing. Fascinating. We did a show probably 2 years ago with a company called eFowl, and it was the first sort of online marketplace for everything in the poultry industry. And that is when I discovered that when you buy chicks to raise chickens and make eggs, they get shipped to you live in the mail, like a box of live chicks in the mail. And that's how it's been going on since the time of the Sears and Roebuck catalog. But just crazy. So do you get the live fish in the mail?
So we get it's a cooler with a box. It's a box with a cooler inside of it with a bag filled with live fish.
I'm picturing the plastic bag with the knot tied on it that you would get at
like a giant store. Like a giant version of that.
With like the goldfish swimming in it the carnival when you win it.
Yeah,
it's
a giant version of that basically.
With lots in it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Overnight express.
What we do is it gets put, I think Southwest actually ships. So the farmer that we work with goes to the airport, brings them a box of fish. It gets put on as cargo, but basically like luggage. And then we drive to the airport and we receive it on the other end.
Wow.
So like within one morning. So we get a call from the grower, from the hatchery saying like, I just put the fish on the plane, and then we get it on the other end.
Wow!
Yeah,
fish in the mail. But people are on the plane.
Afraid of flying?
So. Yeah,
but they don't know because they think they're like in a capsule hotel.
That's right.
They don't even know they're on the plane.
Right, it's the pod hotels.
It's the pod hotel. Okay, so we are going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to find out what Bill Telepan thinks about the Eden Works aquaponic striped bass. Stay with us.
All right.
This episode is brought to you by Heritage Foods. Heritage Foods was founded to sell ancient breeds of livestock and poultry that were becoming extinct.
largely because industrial agriculture willfully pushed healthy heritage breeds aside for more profitable, faster-growing animals. Rare heritage breeds are saved when popular demand increases and farmers have the incentive to raise them. This Thanksgiving, we encourage you to buy a turkey from Frank Reese's Good Shepherd Poultry Ranch. Frank's turkeys are 100% purebred heritage, 100% pasture-raised, and 100% antibiotic-free. Turkeys are available in 2-pound increments. You choose your size. Don't wait. Pre-order your Heritage Thanksgiving turkey today at heritagefoods.com. That you can never just live.
Well, if you're just joining us and you're wondering what the hell you clicked on, this is Tech Bites, the weekly show on the Heritage Radio Network, where we talk about the intersection of food and technology. Do you have an amazing food tech startup that you want to talk about? Do you have a favorite app? Do you have a great idea for a show? Get in touch with us. We are very interactive. You can find us on social media at TechBitesHRN. You can email us, techbites@heritageradionetwork.org. And that's a .org because Heritage Radio Network is nonprofit, independent public food radio. Today, we are talking with Josh Green, co-founder and CEO, Jason Green, co-founder and CEO of Edenworks, which is a Brooklyn-based aquaponics company. And they have just started producing striped bass as a new line of fish that they're going to be selling in 2019. If you want to find out more about them, find them online at Edenworks, EdenWorks.com, or you can find them on social media at Edenworks Grows. We had Jason send some striped bass to Chef Bill Telepan. He is the chef at Oceana Restaurant in New York City. They are Midtown, adjacent to Rockefeller Center. You can find them online at OceanaRestaurant.com. That's O-C-E-A-N-A. You can find them on social media at OceanaNYC. And if you want to follow Bill, he is at Bill Telepan.
It's easy.
Yep. Easy, easy. So, Bill, you got some fish last week.
I did get some fish last week.
So tell us how it came and what you thought and all that good stuff.
Well, my question to Jason real quick is this similar to like the one that I might have gotten like 30 years ago, the striped bass? Because it seemed very similar to that sort of version. I mean, were they always crossing the wild striped bass with white bass in the past? Or is
when you something... were buying it, it was, so a, like, it was a farmed product?
Yeah, or? It was a farm product like 30 years ago when I was at Gotham Barn Grill. Alfred Portali, the chef there, used the farm-raised striped bass, and we would get it in all the time. And it seemed very similar to that. And it was a and the product that I got from Jason was delicious. It
so
was,
what is, describe that product from 30 years ago and the product you got today up against what the product is that you think is different.
I mean, from what I can remember, it doesn't seem different. It seemed very familiar to me.
When so I it's saw smaller.
The, when I, you know, it's the same, we always was getting the same. I think the largest we could get at the time was 3-pound fish, but that was rare. So it was basically you get a fillet and it was, you fillet the fish, you get two portions out of the fish. It was very easy to work with, and it was, you know, very, it was, and it cooked very quickly and easily, as did this one. And so when I had it and I started cooking it, it seemed very familiar.
Did it take you back?
It took.
Were
me
you back,
back
yeah. in the kitchen back downtown?
Downtown. No, and so on that part, it was like, you know, the quality of the product was definitely there for sure. And it was very tasty. I mean, you know, you cook it. It's a mild fish, one that can sort of probably go a lot of ways. You know, it can take a lot of flavors. I have this very simple lemon zest oil that I do on what we call our market fish, and that we just brush over, and we brushed that over it. So when it was, you know, it was delicious. We cooked it properly, so it wasn't overcooked.
Define properly, please.
Well, it wasn't overcooked and dried out. So which a fish like that can do go because it's so thin. And so we were, you know, we were able to cook it, I think, properly. And it ended
how long did it take to cook it properly? People are going to be surprised.
Yeah,
by
I mean, listen, we put it in a hot pan, and we put it on, you know, some olive oil in the pan. And then we, you know, as a fish would pop up in the middle, and then, you know, because it's shocked when it hits the heat, as all fish with skin on do. And then we pressed it down and then popped it in the oven. And probably it probably was done in less than 5 minutes for sure.
So people listening at home, you had a filet. How big was the filet?
Well, I think you end up probably with about a 6 to 8 ounce filet.
6 to 8 ounce filet, less than 5 minutes to cook.
Yeah. And so it was flaky. It had all the characteristics you wanted. It was flaky. It was tasty. It wasn't fishy. It was a really mild sort of fish flavor. All those things that you want in a sort of that kind of fish. You know, if you're thinking striped bass or something like that, you're not going to get the salmon characteristics or mackerel characteristics. And so therefore it cooked really quickly. The one thing I want to say is that when I did open up the package, came in a package, and maybe there was a little of that packaged plasticky taste to it initially when you popped it in your mouth, but it went away right away. But I think if you're getting the product fresh, that's not going to be there.
Did you get the fish whole or filleted?
Filleted.
So there was no, so because you were getting the filet, then you couldn't see how the bloodline was or what it looked like.
It looked pretty clean and to me. So it was definitely a great product. And I think the one thing that I actually liked about, because, you know, we're sort of having at some point really having to think about farm fishing seriously. And I think we are at this point now, as Jason's doing. And because there aren't a lot of fish, you know, people are still consuming tons of fish. And I heard about recently a farm-raised tuna that I tried at this event. It was really incredible.
Farm-raised from?
I want to say Japan, but I'm not 100%. It was a Japanese event, though.
So, probably.
Probably. And so I think, and what was nice and surprising, and I guess, you know, I should have been like, duh, of course you could. Why aren't people doing striped bass this way in aquaponics? And, you know, there's this school in Midtown Manhattan called the Food and Finance High School, and they have a whole big aquaponics thing happening. I don't know if you've seen it. No, indoors.
It's on the roof of the school.
It might be up there, but it's and so I visited many years ago, and you see
it's
how
with Cornell University. Yeah, I've been stalking them to have the professor who runs it come on the show with some of the students.
Oh yeah, we should be able to.
They're
get
fantastic.
Them on.
It's pretty easy. It's so great.
I'm thinking, like, why don't they? Because, you know, you don't, because, you know, and I work in school foods with wellness in the schools, and I think it would be awesome to be able to raise like a fish like striped bass, which is tastier, and this was definitely something that was worthy of a restaurant menu for sure.
So tell us what the difference is between this striped bass, the crossbreed, and the striped bass you would get fresh from New York.
Well, like you say, I mean, you get, I've gotten a striped bass upward to 50 pounds, you know? So you're getting a block of fish, which is, you know, the thing is, it they're very similar in sort of the flakiness. The thing I love about like wild striped bass is to me, it's kind of like the perfect fish. It has like that little edge. There's a decent amount of fat, and it's not too fatty. It goes with everything, and you could just eat it simply, right? And it has all, and it just tastes great. And so the thing about it is that basically you get a bigger piece of fish, you know, and you're, when you can have that, to me, when you can, like, I like a large striped bass, just a fillet, and I cook it in a way where I just pop it in the oven for like 8 to 10 minutes, and it comes out, and you just pull the meat off. So you're getting these large chunks of meat, and, you know, I love that. It's just like eating a big pork shoulder as opposed to a...
Do you serve that at the restaurant with a bib and some wipes?
No. We have done a black sea bass, you know, salt crust, which is another beautiful way. And this fish can be done that way, which is great.
Oh, yeah, I've done that at home.
Totally.
It's amazing.
Yeah, yeah. And that's a good way to, you know, that's a good way to just sit there and pull the meat off. So I will have to try that when you start getting them out and whole. But yes, I think it's definitely worthy.
So talk about the taste of the fish coming from a farm versus coming from the ocean. One of the questions that we've talked about on this show before in episodes past is the idea of, you know, terroir and the flavor of things and the texture and the character of things being specific to where they're grown. And if you grow something inside a farm and it's aquaponic or hydroponic or aquaculture and you have technically no terroir, does that mean it's a neutral taste? Is the taste neutral versus having, is there a taste profile that's missing, a salinity or an ocean flavor or something?
Well, you don't really capture the sea in a fish, you know, but you do get, there's a certain sort of texture for sure. I think, you know, you could take the salmon, a wild king salmon, as opposed to a farm raised salmon, where the texture of the flesh raw is, I don't want to say tough, but firmer.
Is that
sure.
because of water temperature? Is that because they do move around a little bit more?
I want to say probably because they do move around more, but I can't answer that, like, you know, definitively. So, but it seems to me that that would be the obvious.
Water temperature movement.
Probably, yes, for sure. And so on the striped bass, you know, you're getting a little of that for sure. Where on this one, the flesh is a little softer. And that's what the problem with tilapia is. It's too soft, right?
Tilapia is kind of just mushy and gross,
right?
Though.
So, but this, you know, this. So, as opposed to from a wild striped bass, you're going to get the flesh is going to be a little firmer for sure. And so, but you know, the thing is, you're getting a little fillet. So it's like, you know, the difference between an anchovy and a side of salmon. You know what I mean? So, and you're not really going to work much, you know, with it. So, but for sure, you can sort of work more with a larger piece of fish and do different things to it, as opposed to when you get your farm-raised fish, it's like, here it is, and that's pretty much it. But on the other hand, it's one of these things that it's a product that can be readily available, probably at a good price, and feed people fish as opposed to, you know, farm-raised animals, which are really bad. I mean, unless you're at, you know... If I'm hearing there are any antibiotics to tilapia, I'm like, you're kidding me, really?
Well, of course, but so. to Jason, and you don't necessarily need to talk price specifically, but is it price competitive? Will it be price competitive when it comes onto the market? And are you conscientious of, you know, can you manipulate the flavor profile of a farm-raised fish?
Yeah, so...
Or the texture of the meat to what he's saying, the water temperature maybe, I don't know, the size of the tank, they get their exercise.
Yeah, so on the first point, our model is always to be price competitive. You know, we wear our foodie hats when it comes to evaluating the product, and we kind of put on our industrialist hat when it comes to actually, like, if we want the world to eat the food that we produce because it's more delicious and because it's more sustainable, because we're using 10% less fertilizer than other farms, and there's no discharge from aquaculture. All of the things that you think about, whether you're growing produce on the land or you're growing fish out in a river, out in the ocean, those are the sorts of environmental benefits that we provide. But the only way to actually realize those benefits is to do it at scale, and the only way to do it at scale is to be price competitive. And so the answer is yes. When it comes to the terroir and the flavor, there are a couple of things that I would flag. Just on the characteristics of the flesh, much of that comes from the age. So when you're eating that striped bass, that very large striped bass, that 50-pound fish, it's a much more mature fish. And like if you've ever had...
What does that mean, mature, just in terms of days or years?
Oh, so that fish could be upwards of 5 years old. Right. Whereas
makes sense.
Yeah.
Whereas, to get that big.
Whereas our fish and that fish that you were cooking at Gotham 30 years ago, that fish was grown in salt water in all likelihood.
Right.
And so that was a pure striped bass, but was being harvested similar to ours after about a year. And so while we're using that hybrid so that we can grow it in fresh water and in a tank, it does, to your point, it does eat like a striped bass,
right,
as opposed to like a white bass. But the texture does come a lot from simply the age. On the flavor profile overall, a lot of that comes from, as you say, the terroir. Now, terroir is a thing that we can measure. It has been for so long this mystical thing, but the tools of modern agriculture have given us the ability to measure what actually is in that terroir. So terroir is a combination of the minerals that you'll find in the environment. When I say minerals, I'm talking about things like iron, calcium, potassium, sodium.
The salty taste in the salt water.
The salty taste in the salt water. But a lot of that also is the microbiology. So out in the ocean, that would be the mix of algae. Now, we can measure that, and we can grow that algae. A lot of that is the bacteria. A gram of healthy soil has somewhere between 100 million and a billion bacterial cells. The whole human heart has 2 billion cells. So that puts, you know, 2 grams of soil potentially on par with, like, it's, you know, kind of cell density, quote unquote, is similar in soil as it is to the human body. So when we think about how we at Edenworks grow, it is really farming for all of that microbiology that ultimately is driving so much of the health and flavor of the things that we're growing, as opposed to just thinking about growing the fish or growing the produce. It's really about trying to grow the whole ecosystem and driving health and flavor through that whole ecosystem approach, just like you find out in California for greens or out off the East End of Long Island for the fish.
Well, if you can measure it, you can manage it, and you can recreate it. And perhaps it is a little bit of the decoding of terroir. You know, I think so much about French food specifically, where legally things are categorized and called, you know, champagne or, you know, Dijon mustard, not just because of the product that it is, but specifically the place that it's grown and made. And I mean, I do think there is something a little bit romantic about terroir, but apparently not. Apparently you can just, you know, run it through a lab test and recreate it and voila. Does that
not make a lot of people mad?
Why do you say that?
No, I think just, you know, when you think about the French who are designating these products, and they'll be like, oh, well now you're going to grow breast chicken in Jersey?
But we have to say just like.
Yeah, just like a recreated, yeah.
You know, just like.
What was the question?
The question was, as a chef, do these elements make a difference to you? Or at the end of the day, is it the quality of the product and the price point and what you can deliver? Or does it make a difference to you to know that they're trying to replicate the, you know, waters off Long Island to sort of create their striped bass experience? Do you care? Will your customers care?
Again, I think it's a matter of, like, you know, comparing, like, you know, I'm very small consumer compared to the world, right? And I think when we look at what's going on with, you know, sort of tech and food is, you know, we're thinking about feeding, you know, many more people in the next 20 to 30 years and how we're going to do that. I mean, there's a lot of talk about, you know, how are we going to feed New York City in 2050? And, you know, because there's going to be many more people, like people taking advantage of rooftops and you know, industrial sites that are abandoned and putting things, you know, building hydroponic gardens in there and aquaculture. And I think the things are going to be important for a chef who wants something specific and something that's different, that's not, you know, we work with things that are not sort of, or that are a little out of reach to most people.
Well, that's why you go to a restaurant.
And that's why you go to a restaurant.
Fish cooked perfectly, right, in under 5 minutes, right, but also to have product that you wouldn't have access to.
Exactly.
Or wouldn't know what to do with.
Right. And then so, you know, you could go and buy a whole wild striped bass, but, you know.
What are you going to do with it?
Exactly. So, you know, but I want a piece of white striped bass. I'm going to go to Oceana because I know they have a good one on the menu. And so I think those are still be there, and I'll still, and myself and other chefs will still seek those terroir-esque things, but we also may find, like, hey, you know, this product's great, this striped bass is coming out of, you know, Brooklyn, and it's delicious, and, you know, and I love to hear that he's doing shrimp, because I think that's something that could be exciting, and I've tried some that's been grown up in Beacon, New York, and put that on my menu recently, but it was very pricey, you know, and it was a very small production. So those are things that I think we're going to be that way as chefs. So, but it's great that this is all happening.
Well, you are perhaps consuming on a very small level relative to the world, but you are a chef, you are a famous chef, you are a well-known chef in New York City, and you know, bring opinion and information to the public in a way that the average home cook doesn't.
So no, and we
your potential to impact things,
yeah,
is
chefs
greater.
do that. I mean, I think chefs are people who have, you know, sort of, you know, hey, you know, like, you know, buying locally, you know, was probably done but on a very small scale, and I think chefs are responsible for, you know, pushing that more in the last 20-25 years. I think, you know, we're seeing chefs are now talking about nutrition and you know, taking care of themselves and school food, for what I've seen
the
last
10 years.
The skinny chef. The thing I've seen in the, yeah, right, exactly, right? Nobody parties anymore. Everyone runs.
The soap chef.
We're laughing because just for people who can't see on radio, but go look at the show photo, which we'll take after this. Bill's a skinny chef.
But we, you know, nobody parties anymore. Plus I'm old. I'm creaky, but you know, the thing is, I think we can we do influence, and when there is a product that's out there that we all like, we all champion it. We do that, and or if there's a movement that's out there that's good, and chefs are now in a place like you, Evan Hensicor, who was just from Egg Restaurant, was just on the show before. You know, people like him we're advocates for good. We're the environment's messed up. You know, climate change is real, and we can have an effect on that through the food we buy, in whether it's from the ocean or whether it's from the land. And I think a lot of that has been affected. Factory farming has had a direct impact on this climate change, and many studies have shown it. But you know, we have to do something about it. So that's why we're behind this stuff.
Well, it's almost like find, replace. So yeah. It's also easier to get people to move away from something when you can offer them a better solution, right, or a better product, or, you know, a substitute, and then you can shift people from one thing to the next. We are out of time, and we're going to have to shift people from this show to the next one. But before we do, I'm going to ask Jason really quickly, do you have any last thoughts or questions that you'd like to ask Bill while you're in focus group of one?
I think... I should have thought of better questions. I think to Bill's point, actually, that, and to your point about offering better options, Bill's excitement for shrimp is, for me, really exciting. I mean, that's 17% of all seafood consumed globally is shrimp. Seafood or aquaculture, just fish farming, not even all seafood, but just aquaculture, is the biggest protein market in the world now. It's growing twice as fast as the beef market. And that's like, all that is a really big deal. And so having Bill's buy-in to finding great farmed products that can kind of offer that, the signaling, is really important. I think for the consumer, getting that sort of buy-in so that they have comfort when they go to the grocery store, that gives me great comfort.
Bill, any last thoughts before we close? I mean, you kind of did a nice wrap up there in your last pass.
Yeah, I just think, you know, going forward, you know, people are looking to eat less meat, and I think fish is, you know, people want to consume more fish, but, you know, there's not a lot of fish out there. And so this is a great thing to see, and hopefully it'll inspire more of it being done well. Like, you know, that's, you know, there's, you can farm fish.
Huge asterisks.
Yeah.
Being done well, sustainably, deliciously.
Yes. Yeah. And so I think
economically,
it's amazing that we are really thinking that way, but it's something we should have been thinking about 30 years ago, but I'm glad it's happening now.
In your lifetime.
In my lifetime.
Yes.
Yes.
So if you want to see Bill Telepan cooking fish, or you want to hear Jason talking about aquaponics and the future of indoor farming, they are both going to be at Food Loves Tech this weekend. It is a food and tech event happening in Brooklyn. The website is foodlovestech.com. It's 2 days of panels and food and events and tastings and things like that. It's pretty interesting. And it's always nice to go out into the world and experience these things in real life, because that's kind of the point. Technology takes you to the best real life experience.
Maybe I'll learn a new app.
Well, you just got a whole, you got a bunch of them. Yeah. What you have to do is you have to talk Jason into being your Airtable app.
All right.
Or you can join Team Flip, because we're always
Team
looking for
Flip,
new
baby.
Yeah, there you go. You should just go retro. That would be exactly. Great. You could do that. You could start a movement.
I could start a movement. Yeah.
You've already started a bunch of movements. Why not this one?
Well, I don't know. I'm getting tired.
If you like,
actually, I do have a lot of energy, so don't worry. I'm not that old and creepy.
It's early.
So. Yes, it's early.
Okay.
Another cup of coffee will be good.
All right.
Cheers.
If you like this show, come back and see us. Tech Bites is broadcast live every Thursday at 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time from our studios inside Roberta's Pizza in Bushwick, Brooklyn. Our theme song is Nomad, a CPU track by DJ Uptown Nico. We are engineered by Noam Osband, the man with the flip phone. You can find us on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, and Spotify. We are powered by Simplecast. I am Jennifer Liuzzi, and this is Tech Bites.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.